Blog Talk Radio.
Together as brethren, a place for you to sit back and relax. You're here voluntarily. You're here like everybody else to share in some thoughtful and lively discussion. Listen to a bit of music, a blend of relaxation and entertainment, and to perhaps learn and reinforce some of the finer qualities, finer aspects of the order that may not always be prevalent in the lodge. Lodges are robust and have an energy all of their own, have a purpose out of necessity. But as life is full of the distractions, that can easily draw us away from the merits of masonry and our ethics and principles. Let this be a reminder, a mnemonic, as if you need it. We have a tendency, I suspect, to want to speak to or talk to ourselves when we're thinking out loud about the Masonic gesture. I read, for example, just recently that somebody referring to this as a hobby, and I thought it was odd. I don't mean to elevate myself beyond my station here, but it felt like calling a great artist, saying that a great artist is engaging in a hobby. Well, I think it's a little more than that. Yeah, that covers the basis for some folks that it is a hobby. It simply speaks to the diversity that brings us together. There's so many different aspects, and it's so easy for us as part of that community to notice to experience some irritation about the things that are inconsistent in our view, things that should be there and aren't there. Well, yes, there's the basics, and rather than irritation, those are teachable moments where we move forward as thoughtful men always have to communicate. So this is my roundabout way of saying that we're going to communicate with each other today. And we're going to talk as if we were listening to ourselves. What's happening? We need to put balance to our concerns about the challenges of masonry, and put balance to that purposefully. That there are so many different things going on in masonry all at the same time. Those that aren't masons will, as much as we might try, we slip into that service club thinking, or wanting to be doing public relations or promotion of the order. It's more, I think maybe perhaps dreamily, that this is about, we don't want to interrupt a man's, a person's discovery of the order. And it's a bit crass to be laying down a trail of breadcrumbs as if that's what we think. Like, that's a bit cynical of us to do that if we think that's how we appeal authentically to anybody new. Pick up there, let the birds take care of the breadcrumbs. We need to rethink this. And in the meantime, think and be joyful of the presence of masonry in our lives. There's a little bit of something to go with that cup of contemplation. And relax. Put your mind at ease wherever you are. I want to tune in a bit of music here. But I want to know how our listeners from South Korea have been coping, and the Philippines. We're getting into some storms there now. What could listeners in China and India possibly have in common with the listeners from Belgium and Austria and France and Britain, UK, Scotland? I'm more inclined to think I have a voice on the North American continent, but there is always it's the diaspora that I'm speaking to, that we're connecting with today. Brazil, thank you for tuning. Thank you for your presence with us. It really does, in some ways, validates the sense of universality of our fraternal order. And to see growth in Cameroon and Uganda, full marks to us. Let's celebrate that. Yeah. Here's a little help us on our way today. We have really good, John Keats, poetry by John Keats. I think you're going to really have a new respect for the poet. This is by one of our favorites here, Chet Baker, Tenderly. Thank you. Nice way to begin a program, don't you think? The best. That's Chet Baker, the remarkable Chet Baker, such a talent. His work, if you know a little bit about his background, no longer with us, unfortunately. But it's a testament to endurance, I think. Perseverance, to talent. Oh, we're going to be talking about this a bit more today. I think Masonic effects may not be well suited to narrow-minded people. It may test the boundaries a bit. The forceful and people that are so, you know, willing to be muscular and dominant and truly reveal their vulnerability. An interesting commentary for today. So check this out. This is referring to nurturing greatness, 21st century learning, how it is done. In science, and by the way, you tell me if this resonates at all. In science, a formula is a concise way of expressing information symbolically. Freemasons do communicate and learn using symbols. Is it so implausible to consider the ultimate Masonic experience can be codified and taught to all of us who flounder in the wings? The key for craft masonry is to put some serious thought into the question we want to answer, personally and privately. I think we suffer at times from myopia. So let's pull it into focus. If we knew what it was and followed the formula, it would reveal the variables and constants and the relationship between them. So let me lead off the search with a few observations. First, a lodge doesn't have to be a retreat of Masonic scholarship, but it needs to expose each member to the finest scholarship. The cohort of officers need to be thoroughly dedicated to the success of the entered apprentice. For each member, the lodge needs to choose the right mentor. Settling for indifferent or weak mentors produces the results it deserves. And most of all, the members themselves must be inspired determined and hardworking. Do we dare tamper with the capricious nature of masonry to cultivate pearls in our oyster beds? It is compelling to think of this. If this formula were applied to start today, what amazing capability would be developed? We begin with the vision that withstands corrosion, pushback, and impatience. Then we set our lodge right, selecting and assembling audacious groups from far and wide to test a set of ideas, bringing order out of what appears to be unanswerable problems. Can it be done? That depends on how quickly we trust geometry and push aside our scholism. An idea fraught, our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt. That's how William Shakespeare put it. Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt. Ouch. Ouch. Little Jacques Brel. Don't leave me.
Ne me quitte pas, il faut oublier tout, s'oublier qui s'enfuit déjà, oublier le temps des malentendus et le temps perdu, à savoir comment oublier ces heures qui tuaient parfois à coups de. Pourquoi que du bonheur ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Moi, je t'offrirai des perles de pluie venues de pays où il ne pleut pas. Je creuserai la terre jusqu'après ma mort pour couvrir ton corps d'or et de lumière. Je ferai un domaine où l'amour sera roi, où l'amour sera loi, et qui sera reine. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Ne me quitte pas, je t'inventerai des mots insensés que tu comprendras. Je te parlerai de ces amants-là qui ont vu deux fois leur cœur s'embraser. Je te raconterai l'histoire de ce roi mort de n'avoir pas pu te rencontrer. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. On a vu souvent rejaillir le feu de l'ancien volcan qu'on croyait trop vieux. Il est, paraît-il, des terres brûlées ne demandent plus de blé qu'un meilleur avenir. C'est combien de soirs pour qu'un ciel flamboie le rouge et le noir nous découvre une fois. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Ne me quitte pas. Je ne vais plus pleurer, je ne vais plus parler. Je me cacherai là à te regarder danser, sourire, et it would be something really next while the beginning is long, but for long, for long, the man, long to the punch, young man, you keep up, you keep up.
For so long, Jacques Brel was the voice of a generation. Don't leave me. I want to move on a little bit, but first I want to. I was thinking more about that last quote in the commentary today. Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt. I understand, William. I understand, Mr. Shakespeare, that what you're getting at, what you're implying. But damn you for saying it. I'm not as as aggressive as the aggressive men that repulse me. Not as bright as the intelligent people that impress and overwhelm me at times. Not as silly or easygoing as I once was. Damn you, William, I understand that my doubts are treacherous, but things of some permanence mean a lot to me. I met my best friend when I was 5 years old, about 65 years ago. We're still friends, still in contact. He's different than me. I think in so many ways he's so clever. He has an artistic craftsman's touch that's remarkable. And he has enough OCD to produce some incredible things. Just, really. And we love each other. We recognize the value of this commodity in a way, this friendship that's unusual. And when we're together, it's just easy. We can go for a walk, and it's as if we were 10 years old again. At 10 years old, I was listening to this, and he's a naturalist, an amateur naturalist. Imagine walking through the woods and somebody there that can help identify that obscure a plant on the forest floor, or the orchid. Who knew we had orchids? Or speak authoritatively, informatively about the mushrooms growing, or the trees, and the history of what happened, the first cut, the second cut, the fires that ripped through it. And tell me about the lakes and the effects of the, talk to me about the glaciers. Who do you talk to about the air quality and animal life, and what the actions of wild animals around you are telling us about the environment? Man, that's my old friend. But then, when I was 6 years old, I met the girl, a little girl that was later to become my wife. And I'm proud, I'm pleased that our family left, our ancestors left Lockerbie in 1794 and landed at St. Andrew's Point. And so the eastern part of St. John Island, it was the next year it was renamed Prince Edward Island. I like that kind of connection, the history that it brings. And no, it's not everybody's. So for somebody to challenge me and say, I find it sort of confusing. I come from a part of the world where Masonic values are obvious. And they have great meaning across the community. This is, imagine being in a place that would say, you know, honest men don't need police, and they don't need, and knowing it. Yes, we realize, you know, you do need policing because people do, you know, scandalous things, and then they're intemperate, yes. But imagine where that belief, that trust, that honor, that honesty was out there. That was the zeitgeist. Imagine that. That's, we're walking with your grandfather and he's teaching you, this giant of a man who's teaching. Later you discover that he's teaching, he's sharing with his little grandson, and at 7 or 8 years old, and 9 years old, you're rushing along the little lakes trying to keep up with his stride. Early in the morning, going out to the woods to cut some firewood on the farm, and to see how the crops are doing in the back fields. And he's teaching Masonic values to me. Imagine how connected I felt when I discovered that as a Freemason. Where had I heard these things before? So when I talk about the Lamentations of the Order, and rediscovery and revisioning, it's not that I'm giving up or that I can. I don't think I know how to give up the balance that's created in life through the things that are important from in the past and time. No. I think we sometimes have a struggle because we haven't done our due diligence. When you study the history of the craft, it is something that wasn't there. The history wasn't there when this started. We didn't have a major goal to perpetrate or continue the benefits of the order. It was embryonic. It was starting. A couple of hundred years later, it's fraught. No, not so fraught. It's daunting. You know, we have a legacy to pass on generation to generation. Oh, I guess it's easier to pass it on than it would be to create this. My goodness, yes. Let's give credit where credit's due. But the more you learn, the more you dive into the science, the more we collectively can trust our history to help us revision Masonry. But we have to trust the science. That's it. That's the key. The treachery is not trusting the science, William. Come on now. If there was never a Michelangelo or a Da Vinci, I heard this, I'm sort of paraphrasing. If there was never a Picasso, if Picasso never lived, that work would never exist. If Van Gogh had never lived, capturing that expression, the use of color, or Monet or Manet or Constable or, you know, pick one. If they had never sang, that music would not be there if Mozart hadn't, Haydn hadn't, Puccini hadn't, you know, Tchaikovsky hadn't, Pushkin hadn't lived. Who would write Pushkin's poetry? But if a scientist, if our science, if our greatest scientists were never born, 1,000 years from now, the rules, the functions, the formula governing those sciences would lead to discovery. That's the interesting part about the science. That you can, the properties that lead to conclusions are irrefutable. And so they're enduring. It's like science is out there waiting to be discovered or rediscovered or reconnected. But it's not to say, as we know from anybody, that anybody who's looked at the work of the ancient Arabs and the ancient Greeks will contest that there was a great deal of scientific knowledge that seems contemporary being that was being discussed and described a millennium ago. So how do we move forward? You and I are not handcuffed by our second degree, where we're encouraged to study the arts and sciences. Those aren't handcuffs, one arts on one wrist, science on the other. Not a bit. It's the creativity of the arts. Are you going to stand on your hind legs and say, you know, that the art of the photographer is impertinent and derivative, and it's unessential? Are you going to be the one to actually say something? You may say it and you may believe it, but, you know, when you sit back here with a good drink in your hand and listening to the show and sharing it with us, doesn't that sound odd to even claim that kind of thing? Well, it would. If somebody else came by and was talking about the great artists of the time, and without studying them, you can tell if somebody's taken the time to study, to be curious about it, to wonder what bearing does this have on a person's mind, and would it have that same bearing on mine? Unless they're pretty cynical and think that all things in the world are there to contaminate the purity of thought. Yeah. It's a curiosity. And curiosity teaches us about the beauties, the different aspects of thought that can be captured by the artistry alone. We're going to demonstrate that in just a minute here. John Keats is going to help us do that. We're going to share with one of his most famous sonnets. Yeah, but you can see that the more we are curious about this, why would the ancients share this? Why would they open the Book of Masonry at this chapter, the study of the arts and sciences? Well, the arts is that creative aspect. That's time stamped. It's the beauty of the moment. Science takes us into the future, where the arts can describe things science cannot. The arts can describe things that the science cannot. Let me show you. John Keats, eh? You know, this is a guy that was born, he had a rough life, you know? If you were thinking that, you know, I know we all like to feel important. I have certain importance because of my heritage, my culture, because I was born first, or I was born a boy. It's time to let the mind mature just a little bit more. Don't be afraid. We're all a product of our backgrounds until we begin to open the mind up a bit. Keats is a good example. He was born in London in 1795. And his father was a respectable London innkeeper, Thomas Keats. And they were living comfortably. His father died in a riding accident when the boy was only 8 years old. And when he was 14, his mother died of tuberculosis. So in the summer of that year, being without parents, he was apprenticed to a surgeon, a neighbor of his maternal grandparents. 1815, he began medical training at Guy's Hospital. And despite qualifying, he never practiced medicine, but instead began to write poetry. And his first volume of poems were published in 1817. So this is the kind of stuff that the ancients were reading. It didn't attract very much attention, but it did include something called On First Looking into Chapman's Homer. And that we'll come back to that in a little bit. And even a little later, he wrote his very ambitious Endymion in 1818. Didn't really catch on. It wasn't a flame. So in 1820, he was, like his parents, his mother and father, he was fatally stricken, his brother and mother, fatally stricken with tuberculosis. So he sailed to Italy in the hope of recovering, but he died in Rome in February of 1821. But the second half of the century at last brought him fame. Alfred, Lord Tennyson, praised his work. Algernon, Charles Swinburne, and the Pre-Raphaelites. Today is one of the best loved and most quoted of the English poets. Only a few years, and then he was gone. What makes me think, well, you know, he might have needed a good job and a good position, and being a physician would do that. He'd have an income. But think, if he hadn't lived and if he hadn't become a writer, who would have captured this? This is when he was inspired. He was just, you know, he was just astonished when he was reading the works of the Greek poet Homer. He was reading a translation by the Elizabethan playwright George Chapman. So here he named this, On First Looking into Chapman's Homer. Much have I traveled in the realms of gold, many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told that deep-browed Homer ruled as his demesne. Yet did I never breathe its pure serene till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez when with eagle's eyes he stared at the Pacific and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. The imagination, just keeping up with the imagination. This is a man astonished by Homer. When I first read about this, I realized that I hadn't read Homer. No, I have now. It's like some things you read when you're a boy and then you reread them as a grown-up and you realize there's just that richness. And yeah, it does shape your mind. So the more we realize that the arts and sciences are this absolutely beautiful blend that's been suggested to us. Oh, we might be out with our mates at a at a football match and cheering, and that's not the place to be introducing these kind of conversations and thoughts. This is on the walk home or on that Sunday evening when you, or Tuesday morning. Here within arm's reach, I have my grandfather's book of poetry by Robbie Burns, of course. It goes without saying, doesn't it? And I can see the well-thumbed pages of his favorites with just tiny, very discreet little pencil marks, little comments. This is this giant of a man, this man of few words, and exposing his heart to the likes of me so many years later. So if you're like me and you not only have this notion that all things new are bad, then no, I'm not like that. If you believe that it is possible that we've been given a challenge where, again, we need to be able to find the balance between the past and our future, that it requires a trust in the arts, a study of the arts, opening our minds, like we have here. Much have I traveled in the realms of gold. That tells you about the vision in the mind of Keats. But only if you look for it. At first reading, does it make sense? No, no, no. You have to actually put yourself there. And then we have the context. It's all about the context, gentlemen. We are what we habitually do. So the first thing we do is just buy the book of poetry. It doesn't do much good until we open it up. And then it doesn't necessarily make so much sense. Today, we can have tutoring. We can sit down in front of our computer screen and open that book, and we can get some tips and context. It's all about the context. You and I walked into the context of the Masonic Order. We're happiness. The first thing we want to do is we're not going to complain. We're not going to be putting you down for your version of expression. No, there's boundaries and there's limits. It's not a free-for-all. Saying and doing what you want. Oh, no, 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 no. We conduct ourselves always with a degree of respect and dignity for the craft. And we put ourselves out to maintain the harmony of the craft, or we ought. And if that's easy done, then you're not pushing yourself. Very little about Freemasonry is easy. It takes effort. Putting yourself out and knowing that you're doing it for the right reasons. Walking away when you find yourself with those minor irritations. But walking away and feeling good about it, that you're there expressing your commitment to certain principles, that's a good thing. Here, something that I've stumbled across here. I'm going to share this little piece of music, help you get out of this. And then we'll get into some symbolism, some more of the mnemonics, which we walk around with, in case we need that little prompt. The waves of everything going on. I was involved last evening in a car crash. Yeah, my poor car might be totaled. This morning, the next morning, I can sit and feel refreshed. And as I sit down with you today, it's easy to focus on the framework of masonry. It's just around. When you look up, it's just around at every aspect, if you think about it. This is how I discovered this music. This is Ibrahim Malouf. I don't know if you've heard it. Who knew that there was an Arab jazz? Who knew? Check this out. Yeah. The music that's not supposed to exist has an audience in Beirut. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jazz, Beirut. So there we go. No rush. I hope that you're sitting back and in Belgium. Maybe I need something to help my cough. No, that'll do it. That's some espresso sitting here, wafting up. No, join us at your leisure. But when you sit into Masonic Effects, do it with honest moments. Honest moments. Those are moments when you're in the moment you're now. You're not thinking about where you would rather be. You're not thinking about you're somewhere else in your thoughts or the things that you need to do. Go and do them. Or the effects of what went on before, the baggage. Those things exist only in our imagination. No matter the protests we may make. Oh, do we apologize for the new sciences that have developed? Be realistic, never. Do we apologize for what they teach us? It's the interesting part about science, isn't it? It doesn't apologize to us for what it reveals. Well, I'm sorry you're going to be understanding certain facts or truths, and they may disagree with you. Science never apologized. We leave that to the weakness of the human condition, don't we? No rush. In the moment. Relax. Here, I'm going to talk to you about something. This is, again, we're continuing. It's like, I worry. When we get through all of this, you know, we're talking about symbolism, all those beautiful mnemonics, the things that just prompt our buckets of information, and they're portable, they're available. I'm going to share with you a little bit of information captured by Dr. Oliver in our past, and you'll put it together as we go through this, okay? I'm sure you will. I will now call your attention to a board with a few lines and angles and perpendiculars designed upon its surface. This is the tracing board, and though it may appear rough and of little use, is yet an immovable jewel and contains a lesson of inestimable value. This board is for the master to draw his plans on, for the direction of his workmen, but its mystic reference is to the greater charter of our religious privileges. I love that phrase, religious privileges, which in all our open lodges is displayed on the master's pedestal with its leaves unfolded as the visible standard of our faith. Subscribe with the hand of the divinity, the very ground and pillar of truth. You have now before you an unhewn block of marble, rough as when taken from the quarry. This is yet another immovable jewel which points to the infant mind. Rough and uncultivated as this stone, and as the marble can alone be brought into a definite and useful form by the skill and judicious management of the expert workman, so the mind can only be trained to the practice of virtue by the sedulous care and insidious instruction of parents, guardians, and teachers. Thus, the ripening man becomes fitted for his station in society and qualified to act his part with the approbation of his fellow men. These reflections lead us to contemplate this stone in another and more perfect form. It has been under the chisel of the expert workman and now assumes the shape of a true die square, polished according to art, which can only be tried by the nice application of the square and compasses. The mind of the man, after its previous cultivation and progress through the checkered scenes of good and evil with which this life abounds, is here represented. He has attained a good old age, and this time is spent in acts of piety and devotion. The blessing of the fatherless is upon him, and he has caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. His soul, therefore, ripened far glory, may be aptly compared to the superb stone, for it can now only be tried by the square of God's holy word and the compasses of his own conscience. Seems a bit large. Oh, well, you know, we'll just sit and relax and take a look at our own mortality and conscience. Oh, no big thing. Where we've taught to do that, to have this kind of conversation, the context has to be misery and suffering. What naive little creatures we are. Perhaps that was true. And then along came something that was branded masonry. Or you worked hard and you had joy in doing it, but you did it well. If your lot is to dig the post hole, then you apply it. You can do it reluctantly as if it's beneath you. And we see a lot of weak-kneed people like that. Me, grab a shovel, do that? That's menial. I could never do that. Look at me, I'm somebody better than that. Yeah, really. Keep telling yourself that. Maybe one day you'll realize how weak it makes you sound. Or the true mason grabs the spade and applies himself and shows the world and shows the rest of us how you dig a hole and enjoy it. How do you do that? How do you apply yourself to everything that you do, regardless of whether it's doing something domestic and mundane or doing something that is inspiring? Well, that part is the genius. There you go, brother. That part is the genius. Can you master it? Yeah, can you? Show me. Show us. Oh, me? Have I mastered it? Some days. Some days. That's why I have these little symbols. Got it? We'll talk about Ashley's next time we're together, okay? It's an October day after all. Deep breaths. You're taking in your summertime is coming, or your winter is soon upon us, wherever you are. I'm going to say goodbye to you today. I hope you'll join us again soon. Here's a little, I like to say that about music. This is somebody you may not have heard of. Kenny Dorham. It's called Ease It. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness wherever you might be. Hey? Yeah. See you again. Thank you.
Thank you.